The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney.
Kevin, today we've got the second part of the interview with Harold James. We talked about several elements from one of his books, but actually all of his books are highly recommended. The End of Globalization, Lessons from the Great Depression, that's about a 10-year-old book, and then what he published this last year, The Creation and Destruction of Value. Mm-hmm. That was an office read for us. Everyone in our company has read it and studied through it, and we've had a intense discussion over it, which was fantastic. He's also written The Roman Predicament, How the Rules of International Order Create the Politics of Empire. Mm. We have him as a part of the conversation because he brings a historical depth and an insight as a historian and professor of international relations at Princeton that I think are telling, and you definitely get that in reading his books. Before we go to that conversation, Kevin, a couple things that I think are worth noting, and just as an anecdote from the weekend. We went to a birthday party, and my son has a friend who just turned 3 years old. And it was one of those sort of parental lapses. It was so funny for me to stand back and watch this happen because you've got this group of kids and they all down a monstrous piece of cake. And then we go about our business and now it's time to go play games and whatnot. And within about 3 minutes, everybody goes nuts.
It's chaos.
It's chaos.
Yeah.
And one of the mothers says, "What's going on? I don't understand what's happening." You know, I mean, again, as a third-party observer, I'm thinking, it's the cake.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, you put that much amount of sugar in a little body, and what happens?
It's a sugar rush.
Things go nuts.
Right.
And that is exactly what I think what's happening in the economy today. Things are going nuts. On what basis? Just as liquidity hits the system and the economy does stuff that is totally unpredictable.
Right.
But you do know that there's a limitation to it. You do know that as soon as the sugar high wears off,
you get the sugar blue.
Low. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's around the corner. And you just look at the clock and say, okay, 10, 9, 8, nap time's coming.
You can hear crash.
6, yeah. 5, 4, and there they are as a little puddle on the floor just waiting to be cleaned up.
And so what you're saying is the liquidity being pumped into the market right now is what's creating this sugar rush basically in the stock market, the Dow, and some of the bubbles that have been reforming.
The fundamentals haven't changed. The fundamentals are decidedly negative, but you do have the impact of liquidity in the market, and that's something that you definitely don't want to bet on as there is a limitation, and it ultimately runs its course.
Which is the countdown you were talking about before. Yeah.
To a sugar blue. We look at what happens on television. We look at what happens in a context like this where Goldman Sachs is getting grilled in front of the Senate. And we see, again, distrust in the marketplace. We can't believe at the revelation of a company with a venerable name out there abusing its clients. At least that is what's in question, if they were abusing or not, or to what degree they were. And it's no different, Kevin, when the trust of the general public is abused by people like Ed Whitaker at GM, the CEO at GM. How many times have we heard the ad, you know, we have paid our debts in full?
Just this weekend, watching basketball, you know, at this point, the games are coming down towards the end of the playoffs, and you've got Ed Whitaker walking towards the television saying, General Motors is a company you can trust. We've paid back not just what the government, you people, have given us, but we paid with interest, and we paid early, in full.
The irony is now the FTC is doing an investigation, Truth in Advertising, because the reality is GM didn't pay it back with their own money.
No.
This is like, Kevin, you get $20,000 on a credit card, and you say, honey, we're going to pay it off. And you pay it off. Only you pay it off with another credit card.
You're still in debt.
You're still in debt. You didn't change anything except who you owe the money to.
Yeah, this money came out of an escrow account that was given to them with government bailout funds.
But Ed, don't worry about it. The general public will never find out. We're a bunch of patsies anyways.
I guess so.
Lie as much as you want because the truth doesn't really matter. Kevin, this is why there is instability that remains in the marketplace. Whether it's Goldman Sachs or GM, we don't have the truth on which to make informed decisions. Mm-hmm. And it's not just at the level of economics and finance. This is what we continue to explore with Harold James. There are issues of a more political and geopolitical nature, again, where trust has broken down. We look at what's happening in Greece. They lied about their numbers. Mm. There is a tremendous amount of instability in Europe today because of that. You've got folks in Germany who are simply not happy. Between 60 and 70% of the population who says, we don't like this. Mm-hmm. The combination between the EU and the IMF and this proposed bailout, we don't like it at all. So again, there's these rifts that run deep and challenge whether or not the trust extended to the decision makers of our day was a legitimate trust given, or if that trust was in fact abused.
Well, and you know, David, Harold James, when he's talking about globalization, he's not necessarily talking, like we talked about before, a command economy or some sort of centralization. What he's actually talking about is globalized trust, where people can do transactions with each other and actually believe in each other. His thesis has been, at least for the last decade, that when things get tough, that trust breaks down and globalization breaks down.
Well, and some of the things that should have developed alongside that trust was, at the same time as globalization is growing, there should be some infrastructure that's put in place alongside it. You don't have a common set of rules throughout the European Union in terms of governance of banks. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of different things that happen and arbitrage that happens between one country and another. Even though you have a common currency, you don't have common fiscal rules. You don't have common banking rules. That's what we want to go back to and explore in depth with Harold James in that interview. Turning to Europe, what do you think about, you know, in relation to capital requirements and leverage limits? Will the shortness of memory, will the persistence of greed bring concentrated risk back into the financial markets? And in this environment, is Europe going to be able to improve their capital ratios with concerns persisting over Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain?
Quite bad mishandling of the Greek situation, and clearly that there are more problems down the road in that direction because, as you say, it's not just a problem of Greece. There are different sorts of problems in all the Mediterranean countries. There are questions of competitiveness. There are questions that existed long before the crisis. I mean, I think the whole of the European story is something that it was a fantastically interesting experiment in terms of getting the common currency, but some things were really badly neglected, and that neglect having a very destabilizing effect, the neglect of fiscal rules and the neglect to have a common European banking supervision regulation system, that those two problems are ones that should have been addressed a long time ago, and it's quite hard in the middle of a crisis to produce an answer for it. And in both areas, I think that you will see an intensified debate about whether there should be more Europe or less Europe. In other words, more of a move to a conventional type of state or a move back to nation states. You know, and in that sense, I see also parallels with the United States in the Great Depression, in that one of the things the Great Depression did was to federalize a lot more. The government got much bigger. The federal government got a lot bigger as a result of the Great Depression. And that's clearly one of the possible outcomes in Europe. But if it doesn't take place, I would see the pendulum swinging back, and I think that's more likely really to nation states. And we're seeing incredibly focused politics in Greece and Germany, that people talk about these European packages now in very nationalistic terms. The Germans say, why should we pay for the Greeks? And the Greeks say, the Germans have got all these advantages out of their export industries. They should really help in dealing with some of the problems that arise out of that.
And it seems that some of your large investors around the world, whether it's the folks at PIMCO or Warren Buffett, are at least in the United States betting on the direction of planned capitalism, where perhaps we're in a new era where free market capitalism takes on command economy characteristics, and you can see, at least on this side of the pond, a move towards or a reaffirmation of what we saw in the 1930s under the Roosevelt administration.
Yeah, I think there is something in that. You know, it's the investors see that, some academics see that. The National Intelligence Council produced a report a year or so ago of what the world would look like in 2025, and there they took the theme of state capitalism as being one of the distinguishing features of this world that was going to emerge after the crisis. And I think that is the reality of countries like China and countries like India. You know, you have to say in the past, world is really going to be like this. It may well be a world in which there's less economic growth, less freedom, and more of a potential for conflict. So all the bad things that we saw in deglobalization periods in the past coming back again to undermine and to destabilize us. That's quite a frightening thought.
You allude to, in your book, The Creation and Destruction of Value, an idea fascinating to me, which you called deep history. And this is not just being aware of certain facts and figures within history, but having a deeper, more complex understanding of history. Would that be what's necessary to avoid entering into sort of a state capitalism, which admittedly it was not all that successful in command economies? I think that's what was discredited with the end of the Cold War. How is it that we might take a step back in that direction? And what does a deeper history look like?
Yes, I think that indeed we really should look at the way in which our existing order is quite fragile. And that to me in the end is the biggest sense that you get out of history, that you see such a number of radically different social universes that it's possible to inhabit, very different systems, and systems that appear to be quite solid and then suddenly break up. You know, in the way that most political scientists thought that when they looked at the Soviet Union, that it was there forever, and then suddenly the whole picture started to fragment and fracture, and we got a very different world. You know, I think you really need the same observation of liberal market economies, that they too are vulnerable, and it isn't that they're uniquely resilient in a way that the planned economies were vulnerable. There are great weaknesses and great problems there, and I think we should be aware in that particular discussion also what it is that we might lose if they collapse.
The special drawing rights, unique currency basket constructed by the IMF, which seems to be taking on greater significance. Yeah, the Chinese have moved tens of billions in reserves into the vehicle. There's a twofold question here. One, what is the future of the euro as a dollar alternative for central bankers seeking greater currency diversification? And in your opinion, do these SDRs, the special drawing rights, play a greater role over the next decade?
I'm quite skeptical, first of all, about the possibility for countries really managing their reserves through synthetic currencies or basket currencies like the SDR. There is also a nice precedent for this, really, that in the 1980s, the Europeans were very impressed that more and more companies and governments as well were doing bond issues in ECUs, what were then called ECUs, a synthetic currency, European currency unit. It was very much based on the SDR concept. And that looked absolutely fine. And then when the European monetary system went into a series of crises in the early 1990s, that ECU market just completely collapsed, and people wanted the certainty of a currency that was actually issued by a central bank that had a clear analog in the political realm. So they wanted to see a central bank and a government acting together. And in that sense, the dollar was always the currency that looked like the simplest currency. And in a crisis, you want something that's simple and comprehensible. So, you know, I find the SDR proposal really deeply problematical. In terms of other currencies replacing the dollar or going alongside the dollar as reserve holding, that's a much more plausible thought, and I think the euro will have some of that role. I think it's also quite conceivable that if the Chinese were to have some degree of liberalization, you can't have this with a controlled currency that they have at the moment, but if they had some degree of liberalization, it's possible to think that the renminbi might be a reserve currency. In the same way, in the 1960s, the Japanese yen and the German mark became major international currencies, you know, only 15 or 20 years after a devastating war in which those countries had been substantially destroyed and the political systems had been destroyed, but they had good growth, good export performance. That was enough to be the basis of a stable currency. So, you know, the Japanese could hold a model there for what China might do. But I think a number of individual currencies being reserve currencies is a plausible thought. The SDR being a reserve currency, I don't find a plausible thought.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
Looking at Michael Bordeaux's Monetary Regimes in Transition, he and the number of contributors to that book explore the role of gold in the past as a stabilizing force, as a part of the reserve mix for a currency. Is it such today that there is a perhaps central banker bias against gold as a reserve asset, as an inflexible, as an implausible reserve asset to bring about stabilization of the currency markets and in a particular currency?
Yeah, I think you think gold comes in sometimes as a hedge when people fear there's going to be a substantial inflationary development, and we've seen part of that over the last 12 months or so. I would think it's very difficult conceptually to rebuild an international monetary system on the basis of gold. It was a system that worked, as Michael Bordeaux has shown, very well in the 19th century, but it was under quite unique circumstances. You know, one of the things I think people would worry about now is for instance, just where is the gold? Where is gold produced? Africa, it's Russia. This doesn't seem to me to be the best way to make a new monetary order.
A couple of things you focus on in your book, perhaps lessons learned from 2008 and 2009, the limits of the financial revolution. Do you think, also being a university professor, do you think that universities will be teaching modern portfolio theory and the efficient market hypothesis as working models in future years?
It's a very interesting question. I've just come back from a conference in Cambridge where a very large number of economists came together to discuss what might replace the efficient market hypothesis. There is a sense that the old model is broken and people are really groping towards what might replace it.
The securitization innovation was both miraculous and something of a curse. We created a banking system in the shadows where lending occurred outside the normal conduits of credit. The credit markets became accustomed to extraordinary growth with this new venue. How soon do you think the market will forget the perils that came with that innovation and perhaps attempt a resurrection of the whole banking, shadow banking system?
I think you have to distinguish between the shadow banking system and the phenomenon of securitization. I wouldn't be as negative about securitization as most people are today. It does seem to me to have been a conceptual advance, and it sort of gets us out in some ways of this dependence on banks, which has been historically one of the great sources of instability in the financial system. But the weak link was really the relationship between banks and the conduits and the sieves and this whole shadow banking world. And that, I think, is gone forever. I think regulators are not going to tolerate that anymore. And, you know, in my optimistic moments, I think what is happening at the moment, trying to push the dealing of securities onto open markets, onto central clearing houses, away from the internal trading platforms of banks, that really is a great advance, and it's an advance towards what a market should actually be, in which there's the transparent price discovery process. So, you know, if regulators take this path, maybe we will see a reemergence of the securitization phenomenon without the wilder and more destructive sides of it.
So perhaps a return to Glass-Steagall or some other form of meaningful regulation stabilizes that part of the financial system.
Yes, although I think people are still going to be quite divided about this, because I think the commentators have pointed out that some universal banks have dealt with a crisis quite well. Others have dealt with it very badly. And it may not be the concept of the universal bank as such, but the problem associated with banks having these vast internal trading platforms in which they're offering services to customers. They're dealing in securities that are very, very hard to value. And that kind of service then suddenly fails in an event like September 2008. So, you know, my tendency is to think pushing securities dealings into the open, onto open markets, is a more important sort of reform than actually separating banks out by function. And in that sense, I'm not sure that I would want to think that the revival of Glass-Steagall would be the best way of preventing crises like 2008 in the future.
There is, as you mentioned, the difficulty in pricing assets. Brings me to one of the last issues you address in your book, Chapter 6, at the end, The Importance of Values. You discuss modern art and how modern art reflects modern finance. Maybe you can explore that a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was one of the things that really fascinated me. You know, why there was, at the same time as the bubble, this explosion of prices and valuations, not in the art market as a whole, but in contemporary art. And you know, this was an area where some of the people who were dealing in this, some of the people who were producing the contemporary art, were really openly contemptuous of their customers, of the art market in general. And you know, they're exactly actually, to me, the analog of these traders with overcomplicated financial products that they know the customers can't understand and they push them on the customers. That was a world that collapsed. I wanted in the book, in the end, to reflect a bit on why that was, because the art market is very inherently connected with financial markets. You know, I'm just sitting looking out of my window in Florence, in Italy, you know, on the town where in the 15th, 16th century, there was very much a precedent for this, but it was a different kind of art then.
There's values which you discuss at the end of your book, which are very important to the globalization cycle, and markets which rely on a degree of certainty, trust being integral to a market exchange and cooperation. In what are, in your opinion, in what are values grounded?
I think the basis of this sort of immaterial value that you're talking about is a sense of responsibility, sense of respecting the personality, the dignity of others, and where it arises and where the interface with the financial markets occurs, I think, is in the question of debt, the build-up of debt. We've seen these colossal build-ups of both personal debt and government debt, and those debt build-ups, I think, are danger signs. I mean, this is living irresponsibly, whether you're a person or a government. This is thinking, the calculation, I go through the steps a bit in the book, the calculation that my desires must be better than somebody else's, so everybody else better finance my debt, finance my ability to realize my desires. And that's an unhealthy world, and I think one that has had a setback in the course of the financial crisis.
As we wrap up, I just want to end with a quote from your book and then perhaps a reflective question for you. You say on page 277, the only way of dealing with a collapse in values is to rebuild values. Regaining trust is a long and arduous process. That is why when globalization is broken, it's not easy to put together again. We look for communities of virtue, but inevitably we will not find them at once. And the globalization cycle will resume, but not immediately. You have been a student of modern history, taught at many universities. Your professional experience in intellectual rigor speaks for itself in the books that you've written. As you spend time in Europe, as you spend time here in the United States on occasion as well, would you reflect with us on what you hope and what you likely see over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years? What's your most realistic view of where we're going?
I believe if you think we're of this medium-term horizon, not what's going to happen tomorrow, not what's going to happen in 20 or 50 years' time, but the foreseeable future is, I think, going to be actually rather a bleak one. The sense of an imminent collapse pulling governments and politicians together in order to deal with it is going to go away, but we're going to be just dealing with the aftermath of the crisis with poor economic growth for some time and really an increase in distrust, an increase in anger, resentment, alienation. So the short-term, medium-term for me is really on the whole not a very happy one just at the moment.
Well, we'd love to have you join our conversation again, our attempt to understand what's happening in the world and what we should do in light of that is one that's a process added and complemented well by discussions with you and other guests. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to having you as a part of the conversation again.
Thank you. It's been an enormous pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, David, another fascinating insight, but it seems that Harold James really is looking for, not that he wants it, but quite a bit more pain to come before we actually experience a renewal of trust and the building of these relationships that we call globalization.
Well, speaking with a historian and a person who has great grasp of international relations, it's interesting that the tail end of our conversation shifts to something that sounds like we're talking more to a psychologist. What's ahead? Distrust, anger, resentment, alienation. Those are interesting words to be used by a historian in the context of the end of this particular period of globalization. And I would encourage our listeners to look at The Creation and Destruction of Value, his most recently published book, because there are a number of issues which he addresses in it which we simply did not have time to discuss. he looks more fully at trade barriers, tariffs, and the political responses to rising unemployment in the context of global economic uncertainty. He looks at how votes become a little bit more localized and how interest in politicians and constituents being much more critical during periods of financial turmoil, that one follows the other.
A little like Greece right now.
Exactly. Yeah. The common man who could have cared less about whether or not the government was running their books properly, now he does care and is going to give a voice to it. He explores the vulnerability of governments when economies falter in his book. He looks at the gravitation towards authoritarian regimes and dictatorships and what happens in an unstable environment. You either take a break towards the utterly free or the utterly chaotic, which has to be controlled if you've got a government that actually wants to maintain power in enduring power. So there is this tendency at times towards authoritarianism when things begin to break apart economically.
Well, and David, to restate, I mean, he does come at it from an aspect of a pure historian. He's not necessarily making predictions in the book. He's saying, this is what's happened in the past. Look at the pattern.
Exactly. So understanding where we're at and where we're going, that continues to be an exercise for the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, and to see the interconnectedness of ideas between finance and economics, between economics and politics, between politics and foreign policy and geopolitics, the impact of international relations. These are all things that are very relevant to us because they are the context in which we make individual decisions. That's why it's important to us.
Well, and sometimes there are unexpected events from a historical point of view. I mean, we're talking about patterns here that he's watched that continue as far as you go from trust, globalization breaking down to actually war and violence. Speaking of war and violence, there are a couple of things that aren't necessarily historically predictable but could shock the markets. Right now, I'm thinking of the Israel-Iran connection. I mean, at that point, you have a punctuated situation that changes the whole outcome of world politics.
Well, that's what we want to explore this next week, is the impact of unpredictable events in the world of finance.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our continuing conversation with Dr. Harold James. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.